everyone. Welcome to episode 208 of The Book Cougars, Two Middle-Aged Women on the Hunt for a Good Read. I'm Emily.
And I'm Chris. And we want to start this episode with big thanks to Sandy and Deanna, who are our newest patrons. Thank you so much for your support. It means the world to us.
And we also want to thank people who do their shopping on our bookshop.org page. If you want to support the Book Cougars that way, when you are purchasing books, that link is in the show notes. Chris, what are you currently reading?
Well, I'm currently reading a collection of poetry that arrived at the end of National Poetry Month, but it's The Glass Studio by Sandra Yanon. She is a poet. I read her earlier collection. So this is her second collection, and I was excited to order a copy direct from Ireland. Her publisher is Salmon Poetry, which we've talked about in the past, and I'm loving this collection so much. I'm tempted to read a poem.
Please do.
I should back up and say each poem in this collection has something to do with glass. And her parents owned a glass studio in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, where she's from originally. I should also say, full disclosure, I know Sandy. We crossed paths for a year when I was at the University of Nebraska, but we really haven't kept in touch until more recent years when I found out, wow, Old Saybrook is just down the road from where I am. And anyway, long story short, this book is very much a tribute to her parents and her life with glass. The first poem in the collection is called Cut Glass. And the structure of the poem, I just want to say a little bit about that. It's like really short lines that are spaced very differently. Like it's not, I don't know how you'd describe that.
She has the poems kind of dancing across the page in a way that make you really consider each word. It's called something that we talked about when we had Shuli Kaywood on, because she had a poem like this as well, but I don't remember.
Okay. Okie doke.
This is why it's important not to be threatened by poetry. It's okay. We don't need to know all the fancy ass words about it. We can just read it and enjoy it.
So here we go. Cut Glass by Sandra Yanon. I give my lover a petite, stout glass of tap water and sea glass, worn down by years of turbulent waves and rocks. I want her to know the things that have cut me open and made me bleed. I want her to have the obstacles to my once perfect skin accessible in the light of day, so at night, when she runs over a scar with her finger or tongue, she will know the instrument that marked me.
Mm, just amazing.
Isn't it? Yeah. Wow. So few words, so much said.
Poets yeah. For the win, always on that.
Absolutely. And it's this book has a beautiful cover. It's, you know, stained glass. So again, Sandy Yanon, check out her poetry. It's great stuff.
I continued my work reading Break the Cycle, A Guide to Healing Intergenerational Trauma by Dr. Marielle Bouquet. I kind of stepped away from this because I had other reading assignments. And I'm just fresh off a flight from Michigan to visit my daughter. And I was a little bit shocked, Chris, that both directions, one of my flights, when you're boarding the plane and sitting and waiting for takeoff, they were playing music really loud, which was so maddening to me. So I thought, I've got to listen to an audiobook or do something, because I'm one of those people that reads from the second I get to the airport till the second I land and I'm walking off the plane. So I was like, oh, go back to this book. And to remind people, this is a book about the reason behind intergenerational trauma and epigenetics and how we carry our ancestors' past in our DNA. And she has a PhD in trauma psychology. The takeaway that I had from listening to this section of the book was about maladaptive traumatic experiences and adaptive traumatic experiences. And she used this example of a client whose grandmother had been burned really badly as a child. And so then as an adult and as a grandmother with her grandchildren, she was constantly worrying over them about burning themselves. So they took that in and were nervous around cooking and getting burned. So that's an example of maladaptive traumatic experiences. The genetic code for that got passed down to them through verbal conversation, but also the grandmother's actual experience that was internalized in her own DNA. And sometimes we have adaptive traumatic experiences that are helpful, you know, to your future and the way that you handle them. And I don't think she used an example for that. It's something I feel like I need to go back and re-listen to. And I'm feeling that way with the book in general. There's so much information that listening to it is helpful, but I might have to re-listen and or get an actual hard copy of the book because I wasn't quite sure I took that all the way in. Before she gave that example or after, she talked about going through your family tree, both your maternal and your paternal side, and looking at the experiences of those ancestors, mostly to your grandparents' level. You don't have to go back to like your great-greats. But what were their experiences, and then how did you internalize those? And what I started to think about is, but how much of that is family lore versus things that you really experienced with them? Because I think those can become two different things.
Right. And then the anxiety that a parent might have that you don't know what happened, but there's anxiety.
Right.
Right? That you vibe on as a child and it becomes your own.
Yep. 100%. And it was ironic to me to be listening to this while on an airplane, because I come from a family that has some anxiety and trauma around travel in general. And I've had to reacquaint myself with my love of travel and how I don't want that to be my experience when I'm stepping on an airplane.
Right.
Because I love getting on a plane. Like, I feel like it's one of the most amazing privileges in life to wake up in Connecticut in the morning and 4 hours later be hugging my daughter in Michigan. Yeah. Amazing. Versus driving 15 hours
right.
to do it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's chock full of information. She also has these meditation sound baths at the end of the book. So you can flip to one of those on audio. I can just go over to that. And they were just like 4 minutes. So super easy for someone like me who's a little meditation phobic, I guess is the right word, because I get a little antsy. So I'm really enjoying it. And she has a beautiful voice. So again, it's called Break the Cycle, A Guide to Healing Intergenerational Trauma by Dr. Marielle Bouquet, which saved me from the incredibly loud music that they were piping into my airplane, both coming and going.
So strange.
Oh, maddening is what I call it.
I mean, those were late flights that you had. I wonder if the time of day has something to do with it.
Well, one was early evening and one was late evening.
Yeah.
I think it was like a newer plane with these big speakers, and they also piped in the thing they do at the beginning of the flight, you know, like in case...
The safety
thing. In case we're going to die, here's what you need to do. I'm just kidding. That's not funny. But it was like you could not ignore it because it was so loud and on video in front of you and through the speakers.
Wow. Nothing like trying to calm the passengers
right
before you're all crammed into a little tube.
Oh, I digress. But my flight home last night, there was a mechanical problem that they completely described to us as we were sitting there on the runway. And I'm like, you know, TMI, just say... Folks, we're a little delayed. That's right. Fine with me. I don't need to know about the pulley that's not working, which is what it was. So, you know.
Well, I'm glad you made it home.
Me too. Here I am.
Well, the other book I'm reading is The House That Horror Built. This is by Christina Henry. It's a book that just came out. Thanks to Nat Galley and the publisher for giving me a review copy that I'm reading digitally. I wanted something that was horror-based, that wasn't necessarily vampire. And I thought, wow, that one looks really good. And I haven't read anything by Christina Henry before, but I know she has a great reputation. And this book is set in Chicago, which is probably another thing that caught my eye. It's about a woman who's a single mom and her son. I believe he's 14, not 100%. And they're just trying to recover from the pandemic. She lost her job as a server during the pandemic, so they had no income. She finally gets a job with this man who is a world-famous director, writer of horror movies, who has fled Hollywood because of the disappearance of his wife and son, and is living in this huge home in Chicago. And he has all this memorabilia from his films, you know, big full-scale costumes and awards and all that kind of stuff. And she's hired to come and help clean 3 days a week. And they do a lot of the dusting and cleaning together. the character and her new boss. And things happen a little bit with one of the costumes in particular. And sometimes she thinks she's hearing something. I'm almost 40% in, and it's kind of slow going, I have to say. And some of the things that are happening, I'm like, it can't be that obvious what I'm thinking. It just can't be, because she has too good of a reputation to write what I think could happen. So more to come on that. The House That Horror Built by Christina Henry.
I'm touching base about the Phoenicia Diner cookbook that I have been cooking out of. It just so happens that Sarah Franklin, who is our author spotlight at the end of this episode, is a co-author on this cookbook. I misunderstood when I first read about it, thinking she was the editor, but she made it clear to us that she actually wrote the entire cookbook. So we want that to go on record. And I made the lemon meringue pie recipe. It was delicious.
Yes, it was. I can attest.
It has a lot of steps. I'd never made a lemon meringue pie before, but it was so clearly written. I followed the instructions and it turned out really well. I have a little video where I talked about this over on Ingredient One. I will put a link in the show notes. It's a really fun cookbook. I think next up for me is what appears to be a pretty simple recipe for something that I love, which is roasted carrots.
So yum.
That's what's up next. So the Phoenicia Diner Cookbook.
So Emily, what have you just read?
I finished The One in a Million Boy by Monica Wood. Some of you might remember that on the last episode, I read How to Read a Book by Monica Wood, which is also our Patreon giveaway for this month. When I talked about How to Read a Book on the last episode, I said, I loved it so much, I'm going to have to get my hands on The One in a Million Boy, which is a novel that a lot of people loved when it came out. I took a walk with the gentleman caller up in West Hartford to check out one of my favorite little free libraries. Lo and behold, there is this copy of The One in a Million Boy.
That's amazing.
You know, as Chris said, ask the universe and it delivers. I started it right away that night and just adored this book. It is about a young boy. He's in the Boy Scouts and he is helping an older woman, Ona, who is 104. And he is obsessed with the Guinness Book of World Records and wants her to be able to get into the Guinness Book of World Records as the oldest person alive. But she has some stiff competition because there are people all over the world that are like 112, 119. So very early in the book, so this is really not a spoiler, he perishes, the little boy. And then it becomes a book that's about his father, Quinn, and his mother, Belle, and their relationship with Ona. And what's fascinating about this novel is that even though he's passed away, he is so present in the novel, the way that Monica Wood wrote it. She is a beautiful writer, and her dialogue is fantastic. I just adored this novel. I highly recommend it. It is just very poignant. Thank you to everyone who has told me about all of her other books. She also wrote a memoir called We Are the Kennedys that people really enjoyed as well. That's about her time growing up in Maine, which is where she still resides today. The One in a Million Boy, Monica Wood.
I finished Moby Dick by Herman Melville. Very happy to have read it again. And I was trying to think back to the first time I read it, which was, you know, like 20 years ago, 25 years ago, maybe. And I think I had some of the similar feelings reading it the first time as I did the second time, with some sections where it's like, okay, come on, let's get on with the story, because there are a lot of different digressions. But I noticed other things that I completely forgot about from the first reading, like some of the specific characters aboard the ship, the Pequod, specifically the carpenter and then a blacksmith. I don't remember reading about them, and they each have their own chapter. And I found those characters really interesting, even though they were just a tiny bit. A lot of people have tried to argue that this is the American novel. And my only reaction to that is like, there are no women. Like there's maybe one woman who might be mentioned. There are wives or sister's mother is mentioned, whatever. But there are no women. This is all about men and the sperm whale. Some of the criticism I've read mentions that there's basically like a dick joke on every page, practically. So sometimes when you're reading it, you think, oh, is that what I think it means? Yeah, it probably is. And then other things, because of the change in language and everything, I think a lot of it goes over our 2024 heads. This was written in like 1850, it was published. So I think it's a fantastic novel. It's not as hard to read as Ulysses, I think, for me anyway, personally. These two books get sometimes compared as being really challenging books, long, hard books to read. I think if you just give yourself over to Ishmael as somebody who talks a lot and who goes on a lot and just kind of let yourself be carried along with whatever he's saying, especially the first reading, I think sometimes people get stuck up on what does this mean specifically. And I do agree with the philosophy of reading that you're better off reading something straight through, maybe marking a word, circling it that you don't understand, or marking a section you don't understand, but just reading the whole thing and then maybe going back. Because I think sometimes even as you go along with a novel like this, you start to understand. And then you're like, oh, okay, that's what was meant in that section. I would recommend if you haven't read Moby Dick, give it time. Don't try and rush through it because you could get frustrated and then just throw in the towel. But don't give yourself too long either. That was my issue, I think. I'm reading this with some friends and we were reading it over like 10 weeks. I think 7 or 8 weeks was good. And I finished it a week ahead of schedule because I also felt I had 100 pages left at one point. I was like, let's just get this done. Towards the end, you start to feel the tension of what's coming. And that's really excellent. So Moby Dick, an American classic.
I'm so grateful you've read it twice because you read it once for yourself and once for me. Thank you. Now I don't have to.
Well, and if all goes well, I will be rereading parts of it and listening to the whole thing at the Mystic Seaport Moby Dick Marathon, where they read it all in 24, 25 hours in late July. I hope to be able to participate in that, which is one of the reasons I wanted to reread it now, just to have everything fresh in my mind.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how that elevates the experience for you.
Yeah.
I read 2 short stories in my continued year of reading a short story every Monday, and one of them was Ernie's Ark by Monica Wood, because, listeners, thank you, when I posted a picture around on social media showing my finding The One in a Million Boy in a Little Free Library, several of you piped in and said, hey, do you know about her short story collection? It'd be perfect for your year of reading short story projects. So I did get, via Hoopla from the library, a copy of Ernie's Ark, and then I read the title story, Ernie's Ark. And this is 10 interlinked short stories that all take place in Abbott, Maine, which is a mill town up in Maine, which reminded me of our reading Carrie Arsenal's Milltown when we were doing our read-along year of nonfiction books. I read this as an audiobook, so this is my first time doing a short story as an audio for this project. And I partly did this because of the music on the airplane. So I actually downloaded both the digital copy of the book and the audiobook, so I probably will continue reading it digitally. It's about Ernie, who is an angry pipe fitter that works in the mill. He's 3 weeks from retirement, and there's a big strike going on. So he is angrily standing in line, collecting unemployment. And his wife has fallen ill from cancer because that area of Maine is known as Cancer Valley, which is part of what Carrie Arsenal's book Milltown was about. They've been married for 45 years, and Marie is in hospital very ill. One thing I wanted to talk about, Chris, is that she worked at the local library, and in One in a Million Boy, the character Belle, who's the mother, is an archivist at a library. So I was thinking, Monica Wood has a librarian sensibility, and she does write about the importance of librarians in her work. Getting back to the short story, Ernie, as his wife is in hospital, he starts to use his hands because he's, out of work and angry, and begins to build an ark. And so that's what this story is about. And I believe the rest of 9 interlinked stories are about the townspeople in the town and them coming to see this ark that he's building in his backyard.
Very cool. Gosh, that sounds so familiar.
Really?
I mean, maybe I'm just thinking about the biblical story, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, right, a correlation. Yeah. Her writing is so beautiful, and her characters and just the little bits of detail that she puts in. Like, one of the funny things is he's this angry man, but they have this little Yorkshire Terrier named Pumpkin Pie that he has to walk, you know. That just made me laugh out loud. Yeah, so I really enjoyed it. Thank you, listeners, for letting me know about Ernie's Ark. And then the other short story I read was from The Best American Short Stories, edited by Elizabeth Strout, published in 2013. I've been working my way through this one as well, and I read a story called Chapter 2 by Antonia Nelson that was originally published in The New Yorker. And I have to admit, part of why I picked it up is because I often try to read things from The New Yorker and don't have success. So I thought, okay, if this has been picked to be in this, you know, Best American Short Stories, maybe I'll get through a New Yorker short story. And I did. It was rather disturbing. It's about a woman who comes to visit her neighbors, and she's buck naked, and she has an unhappy life. And that's really all I want to say about it. I really enjoyed it. It really has stayed with me. And I think that's the thing that I find interesting about short stories, is they can be so short and have such an impact on your memory.
Yes, yes.
So I'm leaving that one a little vague. You can find it. I'll put a link in the show notes.
All right. Well, you know, speaking of short stories, the sad news is Alice Munro passed away.
Yes.
And, you know, she's the emperor of that craft. But yeah, so have you read Alice Munro?
I have. As a matter of fact, I was having a great little text string with my Sunset book club, the Bicoastal Bibliophiles. We started a dozen years ago with a book club, and our very first book that we did was an Alice Munro set of short stories, which we discovered it's kind of hard to talk about a short story collection.
Yeah.
But we were all talking about her story Train, which was our hands down our favorite. And that is in this Best American Short Stories. So I'm going to reread that in honor of Alice Munro next Monday.
Oh, that's so cool. I'll read that one too.
Yeah, she was a master of her craft, but, you know, kind of a dark writer. You know, that's something to think about with her. If you haven't read her, she is very prolific.
Yes. And she won the Nobel Prize for her body of work. Mm-hmm. In the last episode, I talked about Cal Newport's book, Digital Minimalism. And I believe I said I'm done with productivity books for a while. Well, I had also checked out his book called Deep Work at the same time. And it was just sitting there. And I thought, I'll just read it. Just pick it up and look at it, right? Flip through it. I ended up reading the whole thing. And I like this one more than Digital Minimalism. And I think I should back up and also say, like, he writes for people who are information workers. I think keeping that in mind, his advice is not necessarily for everyone. And the idea of deep work is something I've always been interested in from the first time I heard about the theory of flow. You know, when you get into the flow of work and you lose all sense of time and you're just so focused. He's making the argument that in our society now, more than ever, we need people who can really seriously focus on things and learn things deeply and fairly quickly. But we're competing so much with time speeding up and so many things vying for our attention, especially things like social media and our smartphones and TVs that constantly go off with notifications and reminders and all that kind of thing. He's kind of famous / notorious for telling people to get off social media, which can or cannot work for people depending on what your job is and where your loved ones live and all that kind of stuff. But I should back up also and say his thing with social media is to evaluate it. If there's a social media site that you're on, it's probably going to have some benefit for you, or else you wouldn't be there. But how much benefit does it have versus how much could that time that you're spending on it be used more productively to accomplish the goals that you want to accomplish? So there's that. I always think about that business book that was so influential back in the early 2000s, Good to Great, where it's like, how do you take a good company and make it great? And one of the ideas behind that book was you stop doing certain things. You even stop doing things you're good at so you can really hone in and get to that great, whatever that means for yourself. So I enjoyed this book, and he has another book out, a new book. And I'm just like, okay, Cal Newport. I don't know what it is that's attracting me to this book. I'm so surprised I read it, but I enjoyed it. I think it was a confirmation, an affirmation of things that I believe in terms of taking time and having solitude. He takes solitude a step further from just being alone to being alone with your thoughts only. He said, if you're reading a book, you are not experiencing solitude because you're engaging with another human being's mind. So I really like that. I find that really intriguing.
So what is solitude for him? I mean, is it meditating or is it just like sit in a dark room?
Well, he walks his dog like without earbuds in. He did his PhD at MIT and he was so enthralled by some of these older professors. He said he would leave for lunch and there'd be this famous professor and a group of other thinkers sitting around just staring at a whiteboard, not talking, just staring at this whiteboard. He'd go to lunch, he'd come back, they'd still be sitting there staring, looking at this. So I think for him, it's that not having any other input other than your own mind. So this is the thing, right? When you start really thinking hard about that, the human brain always has input, right? From everything. So if you're walking your dog, you're having input about the things you're seeing and hearing, if you have those senses. So you're always having input. I think he's really specifically talking about other people's minds, you know, that you want to be alone with your own mind.
So you're indulging your own thoughts.
Right. And you're getting your own thoughts because he's just like, so many people don't have their own thoughts because they're constantly being bombarded with other people's thoughts, other people's creations.
Music playing on an airplane.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I mean, that's what makes stuff like that maddening to me because I just feel like it makes, you know, it's just really hard
because
it is about inputs.
Yeah.
But there's also something, and we've talked about this last time, no disrespect, Cal Newport. We're not reading your book so we can drag you through the mud. But I do feel like there's also finding the fine line where it's not just being indulgent. I think it's great that we have academics. They do a lot for the world, but it's also, it's somewhat indulgent to be able to stare at a blank whiteboard.
Well, it's a big privilege.
Right.
Let's just say that too, you know, to have that.
I guess
time
maybe
and space.
That. Yeah. I mean, I think it's both actually. It's indulgent and privilege.
Right.
You are in a profession that allows time for that in your life. You know, and we need big thinkers in the world. So I'm not saying I think that's wrong. I'm just saying there's a lot of people who could be listening to this saying, that's not what my work looks like.
Exactly. You know? And that's why I'm clarifying, right? Like who his books are attended for is like other knowledge workers, whatever that means. Because that's the thing, you know, it doesn't apply to everybody's life.
Yeah.
But in academic work, the point is that you are studying everything that came before, everything that's going on now, so that then you can apply new knowledge. You can create new knowledge out of what is there. And that's what makes somebody a really good academic or scholar, is that they are also creating something new.
Right.
Right? And you can't do that if all you're having is other people's input.
So 100%.
I have to say all hail to my wife, Laura, because she is such an advocate for that kind of solitude of not having other people's stuff in your head. And it's hard. I used to always think of solitude as like having time alone to read. You know? So again, that's Deep Work by Cal Newport.
I finished the Paris novel by Ruth Reichel. This was a book that I think when we had Russell on talking about our top tens, and then we talked about the books we were looking forward to, this was one of mine. I had the ARC, but for some reason I just didn't get to it. It is available now. Ruth Reichel is very well known for her memoirs about food and her life. She also was the final editor of Gourmet magazine. She's been a renowned food critic on both coasts in the United States. And she has written one other novel called Delicious, which I loved. This is her second novel. And the genesis of this novel came actually from her editor, who in one of Ruth's last memoirs, there's a chapter about this black dress that she tried on when she was visiting Paris. And it was by a very famous couture designer, I believe Dior. and it fit her beautifully, but it was $6,000. And she was like, yeah, no, I don't spend $6,000 on a dress. But her editor said, you know, I think there's a story here. I think there's a novel. And that was the genesis and the little seed for this novel, which is about a young woman who's working in the United States. She has a very tenuous relationship with her mother, who passes away, and her mother leaves her money and says, you're to go to Paris with this money. And she does. And it's in the early 80s is when the novel takes place. So it's a very different Paris than you would be visiting today. At first, I was reading this when we were on the train to New York together, and I said, you know, I'm not much of a Francophile. I'm not loving this book. But then I would say right around the 50% mark, I was all in. The story really picked up for me. And she discovers who she is there. And there's one little thread of her life, which is that her mother never told her who her father was. So when she's in Paris, there's some discovery for her around who her father is. There's a lot of name dropping of authors. She spends a lot of time at Shakespeare and Company as one of the tumbleweeds who's living there, just very temporarily. And there's a lot of food in this novel. Ruth Reichel is known for her descriptions of food, and she does not disappoint. But it is very French, so it's French food descriptions, and most of the novel takes place in Paris. Thus the title, The Paris Novel. So I ended up really enjoying it. If you're a lover of food, a lover of France, you will enjoy this novel.
That's cool. I can hear people saying, Ruth, what are you working on? And she's like, I'm working on that Paris novel. And like,
I listened to an interview with her where someone said, did you get pushback about that title? And she said, I did. And they really didn't want me to call it that. And we went through a bunch of other titles, and then that's the one they ended up on. And it has a really sweet Parisian cover, which I haven't really seen with my e-version of it. But if you see it in the bookstore, it's very recognizable. It's like a person at a French cafe table. Ended up really liking it. So we also both finished the audiobook version of James by Percival Everett. Chris had finished it when we recorded episode 207, but I was listening to it at the time, so we decided we'd put the convo off until this episode. Wow, what a great audiobook and fantastic story.
Yes, the audiobook version is in my top three audiobooks of all time, I gotta say. Such a captivating performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of an amazing story.
Yes. And you have read Huckleberry Finn,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
I don't think I have. I feel like the images I have of Huckleberry Finn are so image-centric that I think I saw a movie.
Yeah.
That's my feeling about it. Now, we should say that Melinda over at A Web of Stories, I saw her writing about the fact that she forced herself to read Huckleberry Finn first and then James, and she felt like you absolutely don't need to do that, and maybe it would have been better to read them in reverse.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I could see that. I could see that for sure, because some of the characters that are focused on, especially the two guys that they meet going down the river, who are con men, right?
Yeah.
They meet these two con men.
Yeah.
And Huckleberry Finn, I think they're supposed to be funny, which I didn't think they were from what I remember of reading Huckleberry Finn. And in this book, you see a lot of the darkness of that time period in American culture.
Right. So this novel is written from Jim's perspective, thus the name James of the novel.
Yeah. And Jim is an enslaved man in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And in this novel, James, Percival Everett is the author. You know, he takes that storyline and writes it through James's eyes, through Jim's eyes. But then you also get other scenes that I don't think are in Huckleberry Finn. Like I said, it's been a while since I've read it. But so now I am curious to read it to see, like, how did Everett handle the scenes and what did he change and why?
Yeah.
And how everything turned out versus from the beginning of the novel. I think it would be a really great experience to read them together, these novels, like in a book group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and it would be interesting to do Huckleberry Finn as an audiobook. I'm sure there are some interesting, well, I'm not sure, but I would think by this point there's some good productions of it.
Yeah, you would think so, right, too? Like maybe with multiple narrators, mm-hmm, really quality actors.
Yeah.
Now, did you think any of the violence in the book was gratuitous?
I wouldn't say gratuitous. Was it hard? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you feel like it was?
No, not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt like it was time period appropriate just from what I've read of the time period.
I thought what he was trying to do with that was make it really realistic about what the experience was like for enslaved people and how sometimes we can read these things in novels and there's not much time spent on it. Mm-hmm. And I thought he spent an appropriate amount of time that you would understand the perspective of what an enslaved person had to put up with and face and then go about their business.
Yeah, throughout the story, for those of you who haven't read it yet, we don't want to give any spoilers whatsoever, but through either Jim's own experience or people they meet along the way, you see some of the gruesome, disgusting jobs that enslaved people were forced to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also the perspective of starting to question what that is. You know, that was kind of Jim's role. Like, I'm going to start to push back on what this looks like and push back and push back. And it really comes to, the ending is very strong. I'm mm-hmm. just going to say that.
Yeah.
And how some people were literally in dark, dank places and not realizing that they could potentially be able to change their life. One of my big takeaways for the book, and then we can move on, was about how, and this is, I think, at the very beginning, they're teaching young children how to talk like an enslaved person.
Right.
Where they're incredibly well-spoken people, but they're forcing them to practice how to talk like a slave. And as the novel unfolds, Jim is caught more and more talking not like, quote, a slave.
Right.
And how threatening that is to the people he comes into contact with.
Yes. Yeah, just the expectations of what you're supposed to sound like mm-hmm. and the things you're supposed to say mm-hmm. when you are expected to be a certain way.
Yeah.
And that there's safety in that sometimes, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Very, very good audiobook. Highly recommend Two Paws Up from the Book Cougars.
Yeah. I want to read the physical book mm-hmm. now and then also everything that Everett has written.
Yeah. I read Erasure, which I talked about, I think, at the beginning of this year. And that is the novel that the movie American Fiction is based on.
Yeah. I know he has several other books, but one that has caught my eye is Trees, mm-hmm. which is yeah. memoir.
Yeah, which Russell talked about from okay. Ink and Paper Blog. Yeah. Yeah. I think that might have been one of his top 10 last year.
Okay. So everybody, James, Percival, Everett, we both highly recommend it.
Biblio Adventures. We had a very fun joint jaunt.
Oh my gosh, we did. We made it to New York. We actually made it all the way to Grand Central Terminal this time.
Where, no earthquakes.
No earthquakes. Where Aunt Ellen was waiting for us.
Yes, she is visiting the East Coast. We put this date on the calendar a long time ago. She took the train to Grand Central and then we hopped on the subway and went over to Brooklyn.
Yes, we had a great walk around Brooklyn. We had a wonderful lunch.
Yes, we did. I can't remember the name of the restaurant. It was like Louise's Pasta.
Pasta Louise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was in kind of the opposite direction. So then we walked from there to the Ripped Bodice.
Yes, which has been on our bucket list since we decided to focus our read-alongs this year on romance. The Ripped Bodice is a romance bookstore.
Yes, it's right there in Brooklyn. This is their second location. They have a location in California. And when we went to that Yale Romance Conference last year, the owners were there. I think their Brooklyn store had just opened or it was just opening yes. back then. And we looked at each other, we're like, oh, we have to go.
Yes. And it didn't disappoint. I mean, it's in Park Slope, which is a cool neighborhood. It's not a giant bookstore, but it has really tall ceilings, so I feel like it felt nice and spacious. Right when you walk in, they have older books opened up and attached to the wall.
Right. Yeah, it's almost like a wallpaper of books yeah. that are open, and some of them are more open than others, so you can kind of flutter them, or they flutter as you walk by.
Yeah.
And they're also on the ceiling in different spots, so it decorated really wonderfully.
And hidden around are pictures of them. So the bookstore is owned by sisters. So they had little family pictures. They had pictures of one of their weddings. They had a picture of the two of them as like the cutest little kids together huddled up. So I really enjoyed that part. You know, like you would come around the corner of a shelf and there would be a sweet picture of them.
Yeah, and in their bathroom, they had sticky notes available for people to write messages. The walls were covered with sticky notes, and I did a selfie in the mirror, and we can put that on social media because it looks like infinity of sticky notes on the wall. But that was really nice, and a lot of positive messages. Mm-hmm. Everything from you're awesome, you're powerful, have more sex, mm-hmm. all the messages.
Yeah. And there were a lot of people shopping. It was Friday in the middle of the day, so that was nice to see, with books in hand. They had it nicely organized, I feel like, with contemporary, and then on the end caps, they would have sporty romances or travel-themed romances or Asian-Pacific romances. They had a YA section, a big erotica section, which Chris somehow missed.
I know. I was just like, what? I spent a lot of time in the LGBTQ section, and then at the very back of the store, there's kind of like some general fiction,
yeah,
and nonfiction as well. And yeah, so I was standing right next to the erotica section at one point, because I know another display you were talking about, but apparently I turned right when I should have gone left or something. completely missed that.
Yeah, it was right by, they had a really nice display of Pride and Prejudice, lots of different copies of Pride and Prejudice.
Right. Yeah. And you know, speaking of erotica, you know, Anne Rice wrote erotica mm-hmm. under a different name. Mm. I mean, that's who I would look for to see if they had any of her books, but that's how she started out as a writer, making money to pay the bills. That. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. And then in the way back, they had these beautiful velvet chairs, which is where they host their events.
Yeah, royal looking chairs with a nice backdrop with the Rip Bodice name on there. Great layout. It looked very clean and organized and happy. It's a happy space.
Yes. Yes. And fun sidelines with the tropes, like candles with the different tropes on them, enemies to lovers, and then chocolates with the same thing. So that was really fun as well.
Yeah.
It was a nice store, and it was lovely to see on Ellen. We had so much fun. Chris and I brought her three books, so she was really happy.
Yes.
So it was a good time. We highly recommend you get to that store and or a lot of romance forward bookstores are opening up all over the country. Give them a look.
Yeah. What about upcoming jaunts?
Well, I am tonight going to RJ Julia's just down the street to see our mystery man, John Valeri, who happens to be filling in for Luann Rice, who was supposed to be hosting this event. He's going to be talking to Tom Straw, who's the author of a new book called The Accidental Joe, The Top Secret Life of a Celebrity Chef. I love the cover of this novel. It's like got a bloody knife.
Yes.
And you know a little bit about Tom Straw, right?
Yes, he's really been involved with the New York, Connecticut chapter of Mystery Writers of America.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's been instrumental in those conferences, that the day conference that happens every year in Connecticut.
Okay, okay. Yeah, so I'm very much looking forward to seeing that conversation.
I can't make it.
I know.
I mean, we have a new puppy, a new dog in the house, and so Laura and I are tag teaming. And it's my night tonight. She has rehearsals, so.
So I'm taking the gentleman caller. Right. You will be missed.
Oh, that's good. He hasn't met John, has he?
No.
Oh, good. Mm-mm.
And then we have a joint jaunt tomorrow.
Yes. We're going to see Sandy Yanon, the poet who I spoke about earlier in the day. She is back living in Old Saybrook, and they're having a book launch celebration at the Acton Public Library there in Old Saybrook. And for those of you who've been listening to us or looking at our YouTube channel for a while, we've done pictures from out front of that library because they have this really cool insect that's huge, a metal insect that people argue about what kind of bug it actually is, because it looks like it could be a couple different kinds of bugs. But the cool thing is it's reading this giant book.
Yes.
So it's a lovely library, very friendly. And it is also home of the James Pharmacy, Old Saybrook, Connecticut. And that is where Ann Petrie is from as well. the writer.
Right. And we actually have a video on our YouTube of us standing out in front of that old pharmacy and then walking down to the Acton Library. So I'll put a link in the show notes to that if you want to see the visual, particularly of this bug that Chris is talking about.
But the main reason we're going is for Sandy's book. She's going to be reading some poetry, and she's just back from a month-long poetry excursion with lots of events in Ireland. So I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Fantastic. I was just at that library last week working, so I'm so glad to be going for fun instead.
Nice. The other upcoming jaunt is not until November, but we thought we'd put this in people's ear now in case you haven't heard of it. The Cape Cod Book Festival is making its debut this year.
I am so excited.
Yes, and it's going to be November 1st to 3rd, and the board of directors sounds fantastic. Stacy Schiff is on the board, Edith Vonnegut, John Buffalo Mailer, Sebastian Younger, Jacqueline Michard, Imani Perry, Lee Haber, and Kwame Alexander. Like, what a great board right there. So I think there's going to be some fantastic authors, hopefully some well-known ones and some new ones to be on the lookout for.
Yeah, we'll report back. We're definitely hoping to get to that one. It's just down the road.
Yeah, Biblio Adventure.
So Chris, what about upcoming reads?
Well, I have three.
Right on.
Yes. We wanted to do something to celebrate Jenny Colvin. A lot of you know her podcast,
Reading MB.
Right. And you know that Jenny passed away 2 years ago. It's the 2 year anniversary this month of her passing. And her birthday is actually July 1st. And so we were thinking, you know, let's each pick a book that was either read by Jenny that she talked about or that's on her TBR, just as a way to celebrate Jenny and remember her. And, you know, her tagline was, "I'll have what you're reading." So we're going to make a thread on our Goodreads that'll be called "I'll Have What You're Reading." And if you choose to choose one of Jenny's books that you'd like to read, we can discuss them there.
And longtime listeners know that we did some co-read-alongs with Jenny. So we were on her podcast. She was on our podcast. So we just wanted to honor her and remember her. What we did was we looked at her Goodreads, which is slightly overwhelming. Yes. She was a very, very well read, and she also had a very long TBR list. So both of us kind of went through it. Chris chose a book that not only had Jenny read, but she had talked about when we were on an episode of Jenny's podcast.
Yeah, it was one that stuck in my mind, and I remember she was so enthusiastic about it, and we looked it up. That was episode 202 of Reading Envy. We'll put a link in the show notes to that episode. But the book is called Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. It's by Jonathan White. And Jenny gave it 5 stars. I haven't gone back to listen to what she actually said about it. And I'm debating whether to read it first and then listen, or should I listen first and then read it? But that's the one that I chose. And I ordered a copy that came in. So looking forward to that very much.
Yeah, and I decided to scroll through her TBR, and I got really teary because it just made me realize, like, you know, we all know that, when I say we, all of us heavy readers know, like, we're not going to read all the books we want to read in our lifetime. And the closer I get to the end of my lifetime, the more I realize that, particularly when more books come out every day. But I did scroll through it, and I think she has over 3,000 books on her TBR, and I found one that was one that I had really wanted to read when it came out, and I didn't get to it. So in honor of Jenny, I'm going to read something from her TBR, which is This Is How It Always Is by Lori Frankel, which is a novel, but it's semi-autobiographical because Lori Frankel has a son who's transgender, and that's the main character of this story, is a transgendered child. So I'm looking forward to reading that. We would love it if you want to read along with us, either the books we've chosen, or feel free to scroll through Jenny's TBR or her 5-star reads or any books on her Goodreads thread or on her website, Reading Envy, which we will put in the show notes. Come talk about Jenny on the thread. You also don't even have to read. If you just want to come and remember Jenny, please feel free.
And then this one, it's Neighbors and Other Stories by Diane Oliver, who I'd never heard of. One day, a professor came up to me at the library where I work and said, could you please order a copy of this? I just started it, and I want to have a copy here at the library. I was like, yeah. And so we were talking about it, and Diane Oliver was from Charlotte, North Carolina, African-American woman. Unfortunately, she died so young. She was 22 when she died in a motorcycle accident in 1966. And from what the professor was telling me, her mom, Diane Oliver's mom, was like, oh, you know, honey, you're writing about stuff. Like, you don't need to share that. I'm not sure if that's why. I think two of her stories were published during her lifetime. And then now this collection has come out. There's, I don't know how many stories, but a good amount. It's a nice size book. And I got it at the library. It was on the new shelf. And I was like, oh my gosh, there it is.
People have really been talking about that. And there have been some events with some heavy hitter authors, because obviously she's not here to promote it.
Right, yeah.
Sharing the stories. So I'm so glad you got your hands on a copy.
Yeah, me too. I love the cover too. It's mm-hmm. just a man and a woman sitting on a green couch. He's sitting upright and she's kind of laying back a little bit, and the colors and the flow of it is just beautiful. And then the other book, speaking of our buddy John, Mr. Valeri, he sent me this book. It is called Wrapped in Red, 13 Tales of Vampiric Horror.
He knows you so well.
He does, yes. And this one is edited by Jennifer L. Green. So thank you, John, for this. I just kind of read around a little bit, a couple of reviews, just to see what people were saying. And it's getting great reviews. And at least two of the small reviews I read from readers said that it has a good variety of types of stories. So I thought that would be nice. Interesting. So yeah. I'll pick around in this in the coming months. How about you?
I have a book that I picked up when I was at the Ripped Bodice called The Secret Book and Scone Society by Ellery Adams. It says on the back, an intriguing new series from New York Times bestselling author Ellery Adams. A quirky club in small town North Carolina holds the keys to health, happiness, friendship, and even solving a murder, all to be found within the pages of the right book. So it's all about books. It says anyone who loves novels that revolve around books will savor this tasty treat. It probably would have been a good choice for our year of reading books about books last year. But it just really caught my eye and my attention. And then the other is a joint read we both are going to have. Nora Roberts, The Awakening, The Dragonheart Legacy, Book 1. This is our second quarter read-along. We're both going to be starting it this week. And reminder that our quarterly read-along Zoom discussion will be on Sunday, June 2nd at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. There are still a few spots left. Please send an email at bookcougars@gmail.com if you'd like to join.
Yeah, and reminder that those are always free and open to everyone.
In our Out Now category, these are books that have published now that we talked about earlier on the podcast. Flyboy by Casey LeBlanc, The Gunkle Abroad by Stephen Raleigh, Cactus Country, A Boyhood Memoir by Zoe Bossier. Those books are all available now. And all three of those, I believe, were the ones mentioned by other authors on episode 200. Coming up next is our conversation with Sarah Franklin. She has a new biography out called The Editor, How Publishing Legend Judith Jones Shaped Culture in America. Pub date on this is May 28th.
So pre-order a copy or get your butt to a bookstore on the 28th, because it is a fantastic read. And Judith Jones is definitely a literary person of magnitude who needs to be out there a lot more and on people's minds and part of our social fabric in ways that you really can't even imagine until you start reading this book.
Yeah, I mean, we could start name dropping. Like, if you're a fan of Ann Tyler, you have Judith Jones to thank. If you've ever cooked out of Mastering the Art of French Cooking, you have Judith Jones to thank. The Diary of Anne Frank. I mean, we could go on and on. And what we also learned from reading this biography is she was a somewhat reluctant author herself. We asked her the question, if you wanted to start with one of Judith's books, which would you choose? And she gives us a really delightful answer.
Right. Yeah. And so now Sarah has published other books. She had two books before this one, one of which Emily has talked about.
The Phoenicia Diner, which is a delightful cookbook.
And the other book is Edna Lewis, At the Table with an American Original.
Another very important chef and cookbook author. We cannot recommend this biography highly enough. Sarah is going to be going out on book tour. She has all of her events listed on her website, which we will put in the show notes.
Yeah, it's sarahbfranklin.com. And she also has links to a lot of her articles. She's written articles for The Nation, The New York Times, Lit Hub, Travel and Leisure. I mean, so many places. So check out her fantastic list of articles. And it's really cool that, you know, she has links to them too. Mm-hmm. Like, how convenient. I wish more authors did that.
Yes.
I love the story of Judith Jones. I knew the bare minimum after, like, Julie and Julia, that movie came out. I was fascinated with who was this editor who seemed to be such a powerful woman. But when I first moved to Connecticut, I was looking around for events, and there was an event down at the Westport Public Library, and this was in January of 2014. Judith Jones was in conversation with Adam Gopnik. And I was like, I have to go to that event. So hopped in the car, went down, and just appreciated it so much. And I'm not even a foodie. I might be a little bit of a foodie, a teeny tiny bit, but back then I was just like, no, you know. But I knew how important of figure she was, just the teeny tiniest tip of the mountain. And Sarah's book will really open your eyes to everything that Judith contributed. And if you want to, I did write a blog recap of that conversation. It's on my blog. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. And I didn't know who Adam Gopnik was either. And I know two of my friends, I think, were like, oh my God, he's like my favorite author. So it was a big learning experience for me, that event.
Foreshadowing for the book Cougars.
Yes.
She's been doing biblio adventures for a long time. All right. So enjoy our conversation with Sarah.
Happy reading. We are so excited to talk with Sarah B. Franklin about her new biography, The Editor: How Publishing Legend Judith Jones Shaped Culture in America, which publishes on May 28th from Atria Books. Sarah has a PhD in food studies from NYU. She received a coveted National Endowment for the Humanities Public Scholars Grant for her research on Judith Jones. Sarah teaches courses on food, writing, embodied culture, and oral history at NYU's Gallatin School for Individualized Study. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so delighted to be here.
Sarah, in the coda of the book, you talk about that your last official interview with Judith was in 2013. And here we are in 2024, and now there's this beautiful biography in our hands. Can you talk about how you came to meet her?
Sure. I love that we're starting from the end and cutting back 11 years. I first met Judith in January of 2013. I had been sent to her apartment on a sort of professional blind date because the Julia Child Foundation, in a kind of incredible act of foresight, when Judith Jones retired from Knopf in 2011, the foundation had realized that there really was not a cohesive and full record of her life and work. They were particularly interested in her work in food and cookbooks, the Julia Child Foundation, of course, being most interested in Julia Child's legacy, and Judith Jones was Julia Child's editor, starting with her first book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, in 1961. And I had sort of reluctantly backed into academia. What I really wanted, though I wasn't admitting it to many people, was to be a food writer. And Judith Jones had become really a personal hero to me when I first learned about her through her 2007 memoir, The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. I had taught myself to cook by watching the Food Network and by picking up the handful of dusty old cookbooks that were in my home kitchen growing up in the suburbs of New York. My mother was a second wave feminist who worked, who really resented the act of cooking, but I was interested in eating and food and stories of food. And so that's how I began to explore. And when I found Judith via her memoir, I realized that this was a woman who could provide a bit of a model for how I might come to bring food and stories together in life. I really had no other archetypes or models for that in my own life. And so fast forward to 2012, I'm a first semester graduate student at New York University. I'm not sure if I'm going to stay. I find academic writing fairly dry and dull, and I really wanted to be writing for a popular audience. And I happened to be taking a course in oral history up at the Columbia Center for Oral History, which is a major training ground and also a huge archive of oral histories, particularly around publishing in America. And my professor at the time happened to receive a query from the Julia Child Foundation saying, can you help us get started with this project? We think Judith Jones is an important figure in American culture, particularly in American culinary culture. We have no idea how to go about starting a project like this. Can you help us? And it was one of those moments, there haven't been many in my life, of true kismet. I was literally standing at my professor's elbow at the time where she opened the email. We were on break from class. She was completely ignoring me while I was trying to ask her a question. And she looked up at me. I was always this food person in a room full of political science majors and history majors and sociologists. And she said, oh, you might be interested in this. You're a food person. And I peeked over her shoulder, sort of transgressing a boundary, and saw Judith's name and immediately committed the sender's address to memory. And as soon as class was over, I emailed them and said, I'll do anything to be a part of this project, thinking maybe I'd be a research assistant. You know, at best, maybe I'd meet Judith and shake her hand. Much to my surprise, a couple months later, the foundation offered me the reins of the whole project as lead researcher and interviewer on the condition that Judith and I met and that she liked me well enough to work with me over a period of months. And so that's how I ended up at her front door in January of 2013, meeting her for the first time. We had been set up. We hit it off right away and ended up spending several months in the spring and summer of 2013 conducting those interviews and also becoming dear friends.
Wow. I love that setup. That in the book, you write about how Judith would be set up with authors to potentially edit to see if they're a good fit. I love that it's kind of a full circle situation then with you meeting her.
Yes. And as a consummate editor, of course, in that first meeting, I was so nervous to the point where my palms were sweating. I was shaking. I mean, she was heroic. She is still heroic to me. And she did the classic editor thing, which is she turned the lens around and drew me out about my life. And so in some ways, it really ended up becoming that first meeting interview of me. And she was sizing up my character and whether I was someone that she wanted to spend time with. And for her, that was always about whether another person had a sense of curiosity and also humanity that matched her own.
You also both shared that common history of having families that weren't very interested in food, and you both came to that on your own.
That's absolutely true. And it's something I've actually seen a lot in the many years now that I've been working in food and food writing is that for women in particular, it seems to skip a generation. I wonder if that may change at some point, but particularly because many of my peers did have mothers that in some way were engaged with second wave feminism and had an uneasy relationship to cooking in the kitchen. You know, I think there's a way in which many of us grew up with a notion that the kitchen was something to be avoided if it could be, and if you could outsource that labor or make it easier or quicker somehow that you should, you know, that was a way to have more of a public life, a professional life, to go after more income generation, all of which are worthy things to do with a life, right? But what that suggests implicitly is that cooking is not a worthy use of your time. One sort of kinship that I have found with other people who are deeply interested in food and food writing is that we share a sensibility that this is work that is worth doing and it is an element of our culture that's worth paying attention to.
And Judith became instrumental in publishing cookbooks, which is amazing. And she was working for Knopf at the time under Blanche Knopf, who was famous for eating diet pills, was not interested in food. So can you talk about that, how Judith, you know, really took the reins with cookbooks? And it was really when Angus Cameron came to Knopf that all changed for her.
Yeah, so there's an interesting backstory here. So the way that Judith ended up getting hired at Knopf was because Blanche Knopf, who was part of the co-founding partnership of Alfred A. Knopf, her husband, Alfred Knopf, of course, his name is on, you know, officially on the name of the publishing company and hers never was, but they founded it together from the start in 1915. Blanche Knopf really wanted to publish the Diary of Anne Frank in English. And all of her colleagues at Knopf had said, this book will never sell. You know, there's nothing here, as did many other American publishers. But Judith, who had started as an intern at Doubleday while she was a college student in the early 1940s, and then through sort of a long series of moxie and serendipity, ended up working for Doubleday's Parisian outpost in Paris, starting in 1949. Judith ended up pulling the Diary of Anne Frank out of the reject pile and making a case for its publication in English. Her boss there had already rejected the manuscript and had asked her to write the rejection letter and send it off to Anne Frank's father. And Judith, in a classic Judith Jones move, she sort of went right around the hierarchy and decided to take things into her own hands and read the book when he was out for lunch one day. And when he came back, she said, "We've got to publish this book." She was incredibly moved by the story, but also by the voice. And she recognized that it was unique both in its literary contribution and its historical contribution. We know how this story goes. The book ended up being published in English, and that is because of Judith Jones's advocacy for it. It is considered a publishing phenomenon. There have been very few books like it on a global scale. And so Doubleday made huge profit off that book. And Blanche Knopf had been wildly jealous that that wasn't a success that Knopf got to claim. And so when she found out that Judith, who was then back in New York, was responsible for that sort of audacious move, she offered her a job as her assistant. And so Judith began working at Knopf in 1957. Blanche Knopf was a very, very erudite, serious literary person. She had incredible taste. She was known for traveling all over the globe to recruit talent for Knopf, but she was not respected as an equal at the house. And she was the only woman there at the time until Judith was hired, who became the second outside of the secretarial pool. And part of Blanche's sense of seriousness was that women who were involved in literature needed to do, you know, quote unquote, serious literary stuff. And food certainly was not that. Her husband, however, Alfred Knopf, was very interested in food, and through huge lavish parties, he loved to eat. He'd even published a couple of books on food under the Knopf banner. So in 1959, when the manuscript that became Mastering the Art of French Cooking came to Knopf, it had already been rejected by Houghton Mifflin and had previously been under contract there. But they felt the book was too complicated and too long for an American audience. And so after two full revisions, they had rejected it and canceled the contract. And it came by way of a friend of the Knopf's to Knopf. It ended up on Judith's desk because people knew that she had lived in Paris. She was interested in food. And so William Koshland, who was one of the higher ups at Knopf at the time, brought it to Judith and said, "Will you take a look at this?" Assuming it would be rejected, assuming they would say no. And she took it home in pieces and began cooking from it. And she realized that it was a remarkable book that allowed her to replicate the kinds of cooking she had done when she was living in Paris. And she had been looking for just that kind of a book. And she had a hunch that it could really change American sensibility and taste, and also attitudes towards home cooking as something that could be a serious and pleasurable pursuit. And so because she was so junior at Knopf, she was not allowed yet into editorial meetings at all. And so she formed sort of an alliance with Angus Cameron, who was, again, a senior editor at Knopf at the time, who also was interested in food and cooking, and who had worked on cookbooks himself in a previous job. And so he understood how to publish them. He understood what could make them successful or make them failures. And he agreed with her. He took a look as well. He agreed that it was a remarkable book. And so it was actually he who ended up pitching the book in the editorial meeting, but was very clear that it was to be Judith's if Knopf agreed to publish it. And so that's how she ended up working with Julia Child and her two co-authors, Simone Beck and Louise Bertol, on the book that became Mastering the Art of French Cooking, that was published in 1961 and started her career in cookbooks in earnest.
Wow. Yeah. You mentioned Judith going around the patriarchy. And there was a quote from the book that we wanted to read because you write something so succinctly. And again, we should remind listeners that the subtitle is How Publishing Legend Judith Jones Shaped Culture in America. So this is a biography and an argument at the same time. So you write in the introduction, "Misogyny shaped the arc of her life and career and continues to diminish her legacy today."
Yeah, and then I marked in my copy of the book, and this is later on, her relationship with Bob Gottlieb, who comes to Knopf, and there's a point where people were confronting Bob Gottlieb about the pay that Judith was getting, because at this point, she's very successful in her career. She's making so much money for the publishing house. And other people who have asked him for a raise said, "I'm worth this, and if you don't give it to me, I'm leaving." That's what a person should do to be assertive. Not everyone can go around wasting their time intuiting your feelings, which you're afraid to express. Judith was at a certain level that other editors were at, and she was paid in relation to that. She made as much as the colleagues who produced as much as she did. This is Gottlieb speaking to you. And this is the thing that made me write in the side, "fuckwad," which I have never written in a book in my life. He says, "I have always been a feminist. I hired women. I admired them. I worked with them. I paid them." And then he said, "Judith had a rich husband." That's where I wrote "fuckwad." So let's talk about misogyny in publishing.
This is a big one. Where do we begin?
You know, she made so much money for the industry and had such an impact, but was also a woman of a certain generation. So maybe that's where we should begin.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, this is the question more than any other question or the topic, I should say, that makes me want to say to people, just go read the book, because it is a through line that I was very deliberate about making sure I carried through the entirety of the book. And it was one of the hardest things to trace, honestly, in terms of research, because Judith's relationship to politics and feminism was complicated and not overt. She was someone who, it makes absolute sense to me that she chose to spend her life as an editor rather than an author, though she did write at the tail end of her life, because she was someone who really exercised her power from the wings from a very, very early age. And she recognized how systems of power worked, and she never tried to burn them down or intercept them. She learned how to work within them to get done what she wanted to do. And so that makes her a sort of uncomfortable subject for someone like me who wants her or wanted her to claim feminism as her stance, who wanted her to have a kind of more outright relationship to a movement and a politics that suggested that she deserved to be treated as an equal in every realm, whether that was her marriage, whether it was at work or in any other place. But she wasn't. And that was made clear through the facts of her pay, through the things that her former editor-in-chief said sort of shamelessly to me, which was just incredible to me that he was willing to go on record saying that, very defensively, I might add. But he nearly kicked me out of, this is Bob Gottlieb, Gottlieb nearly kicked me out of his apartment when I asked about her pay. I have to say, he was not happy to be asked about that. You know, the story about Judith asking for a raise, and for people who haven't read the book, it was the only time she did it during his 20-year tenure there. She had only asked for a raise at Knopf one other time in her 56 years. It was very soon after she began. But just to be clear, the person who pointed out to Judith that she thought Judith was being underpaid was a former colleague of Judith's, not at Knopf, but at Doubleday. This woman named Betty Prashker, who shared an office with Judith in 1948. They were two women readers among a sea of men. Doubleday at the time was the biggest publisher in the English-speaking world. It was massive. And their job was to read through manuscripts that had come in and then suggest whether they should be published by Doubleday. So they weren't doing a ton of editing at the time, but they were instrumental in deciding which books Doubleday did publish. Many years later, Betty Prashker had taken a very different tack than Judith. And after a 10-year break to have three children and raise them, she came back to Doubleday as a very, very powerful editor who published a lot of overtly feminist books. And she rose the ranks. And they had always had an interesting relationship to one another. They remained friends and colleagues over the decades. And Betty sort of didn't quite understand why Judith didn't ask for more from the jump. She was making, as you say, all this money for Knopf. She was publishing across genres, poetry, fiction, nonfiction, scholarly work, and cookbooks, of course. And it was clear to Betty that Judith was worth a hell of a lot more than she was being paid. This came up over lunch one day when they were just sort of swapping war stories about the industry. And Judith admitted to how much she was making, and Betty was appalled. And she said, "You have got to go ask for a raise." And so it took Judith a while, and her husband, Judith's husband, had for a long time been saying, "You need to be making more money. They're not valuing you at work." Judith screwed up her courage and finally went to Gottlieb and asked for this raise. And in the way that you just illustrated by reading that quote, not only did he deny her a raise, but he really gaslit her left and right about whether she was worth any more than she was making. And of course, why should you even get a raise? Because you have a rich husband, which, you know, is neither here nor there. Partners are legally or domestically should have no bearing on how anyone is compensated in the workplace. But it also wasn't true. Judith was in a very unconventional marriage where her husband, who was a freelance writer and did not earn a regular paycheck, was responsible for a lot of the housework and was also the one who was home when the kids that they were raising came home in the afternoons after school. And Judith was putting in long hours at the office. And so it really added insult to injury, because what he was telling her was that it wasn't just that her books weren't worth enough to him to give her a raise, but that by virtue of being a woman and married to a man, there was no reason why she should even ask. And I think there's a way in which Judith's pain around feeling like she was not valued in the way that she wanted to be at work was always compounded by her sex and gender, right? Because left and right, people were being told, she was being told that you shouldn't even ask, right? It's not just that you're worth it, but that to ask is somehow stepping out of line. And unfortunately, and sort of a great sadness of this book to me, is that she really internalized that. And she never asked for a raise again. She remained at Knopf for several decades after that. And the amount of money she was making when she died, when I found that tax return in her personal archive, I was appalled because of the millions upon millions upon millions of dollars that she had made for them over the decades. And that had just never been valued in terms of her compensation and pay.
Right. And when we say millions, I mean, we're talking about Mastering the Art of French Cooking, The Diary of Anne Frank, although The Diary of Anne Frank wasn't being money being made for Knopf, yeah. But it was where her, you know, part of her gravitas came from as an editor. But John Updike, Anne Tyler, we could go on and on. And that's not even talking about other cookbook authors.
Speaking of the research that you did, we were wondering what your research process is like. And where did you start? How long did it take? You mentioned 11 years at one point. And then how did you stay organized to be able to start writing, or did you write as you went along?
I was not organized. Let me start by saying this was not an organized or linear process. So when I began interviewing Judith in 2013, it was work for hire for somebody else. So at that point, I had no notion that I was going to write a book about Judith. I did, in fact, end up completing that PhD that I had started. I did write my dissertation about Judith based on those interviews that we did together over several months in 2013. And then I put it away. I had also had twins in the meantime. And so right before I defended my dissertation, I had infant twins. The turning point really happened in 2017. So Judith was diagnosed with Alzheimer's sometime in those last years of her life. I was not told exactly when it happened, but I was made aware of it by late 2015. And I found out through Judith's stepdaughter, Bronwyn Dunn, who I had stayed in touch with via email. She knew that Judith and I had developed a friendship when we were working together and that we still had lunch together on occasion. We were really fostering an intimate, friendly relationship that transcended our professional work together. And so when Judith started to decline, she kept me in the loop in a way that I was so grateful for. I went to visit Judith for the last time in the spring of 2017. I had, in the years I'd known her, left New York City and moved upstate. I'd gotten married. I'd gotten pregnant. I had given birth to twins. And after Judith died in August of 2017, Bronwyn invited me to a small memorial service for family and friends up in Vermont, where Judith spent about a third of every year. And when the service was over, she pulled me aside. She said, you know, I've just begun to kind of wrap my head around the New York City apartment and assess what's there and what we're going to do with it all. And there are an awful lot of papers there. You know, I know you've written a little bit about Judith, which indeed I had at that point. I had written a dissertation and published a couple of small articles about her impact, particularly in food and cooking. And Bronwyn said, would you like to come have a look? And I knew immediately in my gut that I was in no place to be taking on a project of any sort of project. I had 11-month-old twins. I was back to teaching. I had a husband at the time who was a working chef, working 80, 90-hour weeks. I was exhausted and very busy. But I also loved and admired Judith and had really, by that point, become troubled to the point of angry that there had been nothing big written about her life and sort of celebrating her importance beyond food and cooking, sort of to American culture as a whole. And so I took a deep breath and I said, yeah, I'd love to come take a look. And so in November of 2017, I went back to the apartment where I had conducted my first interviews with Judith. And Bronwyn walked me into what used to be Judith's husband's office and then into a room behind it that I didn't even know existed. This was a small office in what used to be a second bathroom in the apartment. And both rooms were entirely filled, floor to ceiling and wall to wall, with marked up manuscripts, with files full of correspondence, clippings, notebooks, letters, handwritten and airmail letters dating back to the 1930s. The room that had once been a bathroom had a piece of plywood set over the bathtub, and then there were file cabinets stacked on top of it. And I sort of gasped. I mean, for anyone who has any interest in history, even if you don't have a connection to your subject, there's something about realizing that you've just stumbled onto a treasure trove that you cannot ignore. But this was a woman I loved, I mean, deeply personally, and also so admired. And so in this incredible, incredible move of trust and faith, Bronwyn let me start taking those materials home box by box, because I couldn't do the commute back and forth to New York City at the time with these young children at home. And so I'd take a few home, read through them, scan some of them, take photos, and then I'd return them to her and take some more. I did that for 2 years before I even wrote my book proposal for this book. I sold the book in early 2019. It was a very difficult sell. A lot of publishers told my agent that it felt too much like inside baseball, that people outside of publishing would not be interested in a biography of an editor, that the scope felt too narrow, that Judith wasn't a household name, and so the book wouldn't sell. And finally, we did find a woman editor who was very interested in the book and bit. And once I sold the book, I had the money that I needed to sort of justify my working time, which allowed me to set off doing interviews with many of the people who knew Judith while she was alive. That was family members, friends, colleagues, and also to travel to the enormous Knopf Archive at the University of Texas at Austin, the Ransom Center, which is a really, really world-class library, and spend plenty of time there, though I didn't get to every single thing that I wish I had, looking at Judith's early editorial files from her first 20 years there. So this book took forever to write and went through many iterations. Subsequently, COVID happened. I went through a divorce. My children were growing up. I published two other books in the meantime. So there was a lot going on. And in retrospect, I'm really grateful for all that time, because I think the book had a chance to really become a distilled version of several kind of bigger, more sprawling versions that I had drafted during those 11 years.
Oh, well, the writing itself is so beautiful. It reads, I mean, it's just, I don't know what the descriptor is to say how beautifully this biography reads. Like, it's a pleasure to read. And I feel like I'm there somehow in the room with whatever you're writing about.
Yeah, we wanted to ask you about the writing style.
Yeah, so we're each going to read a paragraph. And this is from page 19 that I'll read. Judith checked her lipstick in the mirror and tucked a loose pin back into her hair. In her reflection, she saw a waiter come into view carrying a tray of Manhattans. She swirled around to grab one before he passed her by. Turning to face the room, Judith nibbled one of the cherries from her drink. The apartment's windows were thrown open to the hot night. The laughter and clinking of glasses from the party floated out over Central Park.
And then this is much later in 2006, and this is when Judith is at her home in Vermont, in northern Vermont, where she spent a lot of time. It was late in the evening. Judith sat on the back deck at Bryn Terg. Her hair was still damp from her evening swim. A clean plate and an empty wine glass sat on the table beside her. She'd cooked herself dinner and eaten it by candlelight, as she'd continued to do each evening since Dick's death. Away to the northwest, the green mountains were cast in silhouette, a rugged underline of the dimming sky. The sinking sun dragged its embers down, setting the shelved clouds above the ridge of flame. The birds had grown quiet, bats darted and swooped. From below in the pasture came the soft snap of cattle tearing at meadow fodder with their teeth and the slow, heavy thud of their footfalls as they grazed. With the help of her cousin and neighbor, John Reynolds, Judith had brought a small herd of Black Angus to Brintag earlier that year. They were raising them for beef. Judith shivered, the chill of dusk setting in. It was June 2006, nearly the summer solstice. Soon the days would begin to grow shorter in a long, slow denouement. Judith could feel the turn coming like a charge. She was brimming with it. She stilled herself, her gaze fixed in reverie as the horizon smoldered.
Yeah, so these two examples, one was from the 1940s, the other one is from 2006. And our question, you know, talking about the style of this, you know, the narrative nonfiction, it's like, are you documenting or creating something that could have happened? Can you talk a little bit about these two scenes in particular?
Yeah. So in part, this is a response that took me years to kind of come up with, which was, you know, most biographies are unreadable. If we're being honest about it, they are way too long. They are a compilation of fact and detail much more than they are works of narrative. And I knew that I wanted to write a book that people wanted to read, or it would actually be a disservice to trying to bring attention to Judith's life and legacy. So part of it was, as a lifelong reader, making sure that this was a book that had a propulsive pace to it that felt like a story in as much as it was sharing fact and documented information about her life. These scenes, and I open each chapter of the book with a scene and then go into a slightly different narrative style that I think is a little more akin to journalism, I would say, to sort of profile writing, were made up of compilations of details from letters, from photographs, from stories that Judith told, from stories that people who knew Judith had told me, from her date books, which she kept, which was an incredible gift. I actually did know where she was a lot of the time across her life. So I was able to sort of get down onto that daily level, but also through my experience of knowing her and having a sense of how she actually spent her days and her time and how that changed across her life from anecdotes she had shared with me. And so I wanted to open each chapter, each of which is sort of loosely themed or tries to shed light on a part of her life that felt significant, by drawing the reader in with sensory detail, with a feeling of closeness and intimacy to her that really humanized her. What this book is not is everything that could ever be said about Judith. There are many, many writers that she worked with that I did not include here because I had to make choices. I tried very hard to be guided both by the authors that seemed to markedly shape shifts in her editorial taste or her personal sensibility across time, but also the authors that were important to me. And so, as I say in the introduction to this book, this is just one telling, and it is absolutely, and I wanted to be very transparent about this, cast through my own experience and my own sensibilities. So in a way, there's sort of a way in which I'm editing Judith's life in the telling of this book, and some other biographer could do a very different version of telling her story through their own interests, through looking at the same materials that I had access to.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that explanation. And one of the other things I like is more of a structural issue or style, is that you just, within each chapter, there are also several different line breaks of little sections. That helps you also keep reading because there's so much information, but just that little break could be like, okay, I'm going to keep going, or okay, good, I can stop here and go have dinner. And then very lovely set up that way.
Thank you.
One of the other things you mentioned is that Judith was an author in her own right, somewhat reluctant. You know, if someone were to start with a book of Judith's, do you have a recommendation?
Oh, yeah. A clear favorite, her first solo cookbook, The Pleasures of Cooking for One, I think is both a very lovely and useful book, but I also think it expresses a very radical politics. Judith was 85 years old when she published that book, and we generally do not in American culture, and I think in many cultures, associate not just older, but old women with pursuing their own pleasure and expressing it publicly. And so to frame an entire book around the pursuit of pleasure only for oneself and not in the service of anybody else, I think is just an extraordinary act of vision, very reflective of Judith's love of making mischief and putting things in front of people that might make them a little bit uncomfortable or might make them reconsider the way they've thought about the world. But it's also a really pragmatic book, I think, in that it speaks to the ways people actually cook and live in their daily lives. So she makes great use of leftovers. She talks about making mistakes and doing things over or riffing on the spot because no one's looking. She talks about the importance of setting yourself a beautiful table, whatever that beauty looks like or means to you, just in order to carve out a space in your life that is about delight, that is about sensuality. She was really someone who believed her entire life, especially as the 20th century progressed and got noisier and noisier, right? It sped up, more technology coming into our homes, encouraging us to go faster and faster. She was really experiencing that in publishing and trying very hard to resist it. That creating that space and quiet for oneself is a vital tool of longevity and really even of survival, both of the body and of the spirit. And so I think of that book as kind of an incredible testament, looking from late in her life at how does one do this for oneself in a culture that demands that we live at a surface level, that we move very quickly, that we put ourselves last. She was saying, no, you have to find a way to integrate this into your daily life so that you can turn your attention to your rigorous work, so that you can give yourself over to the public eye when it is asked of you. And then also saying for women, especially, not exclusively, but especially, that we do not exist only in the service of others, that we also should be living in the service of ourselves and our own growth and pleasure.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, mic drop.
Yes. So one question I'd have is just since your manuscript was finalized, have you learned other things about Judith that you wish could have been included?
No. One tremendous gift of spending so long working on this book is that I sort of closed the research long before I drafted and revised and revised and revised and revised the book. There were years where I was both researching and writing. I'm someone who needs to write more drafts than I would care to admit, write longhand notes before I even put them in the computer. And then I write like four or five times the length and then I cut it back down. That's just how I process information and begin to make sense of what I'm seeing and absorbing and thinking and what I want to say. Again, I did close the door on certain elements of research that I probably could have gone further into, but I knew I needed to make choices. Maybe this is a nice way to sort of close the loop, is that good editing is not just about making things sound good on the page or drawing out a good story. It's about what you don't include, right? And so I think we often take that for granted, particularly in the realm of biography, that making deliberate choices that can help a reader hone their attention, pay more attention to someone's proclivities or personality or quirks in a way that helps them focus is actually a gift to the reader. Because if you give them everything, they don't know what they should be paying attention to, and it becomes as disorienting as wandering into an archive for the first time. And so it felt very important to me, again, to sort of crystallize the argument that I, or arguments, I should say, that I wanted to make about Judith's life and why she was important and why we should be talking about her and remembering her, but also helping the reader move through what was a very long and dizzyingly rich life and career.
Lovely.
Yeah, such a great read.
It is.
Thank you so much.
Such a great book, Sarah. Really, thank you so much for writing it. She's such an important person in history, and it just was a delight to read. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The Book Cougars with Chris Wallach and Emily Fine. We'll be back again with another episode in 2 weeks. Until then, come chat with us on social media, Goodreads, or email us at bookcougars@gmail.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast, please tell others about us, leave a review wherever you listen, and consider becoming a patron. Even $1 a month is a big help. Learn more about that on our website, bookcougars.com, where you'll find the show notes for this and all of our past episodes.
Thanks, everybody.
This episode was edited by Pat Keough Sound Design.